ओमिज्ञानतिमुरन्दस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकय चक्षुरुन्मुदतं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरुवे नमः. श्रीचैतन्योपीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपाकृदामायं ददाति सा प्रदन्तिकम्. वैराग्ययुद्भक्तिविषं प्रयत्नाय अपायमामरभप्समन्दम् कृपं भूया परदुःखदुःखी सनातनस्थं प्रभुमस्मरामि. पञ्चकौपाकरूभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभयेव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः. श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द याद्वैत गदाधर शिवासदि गौरभक्तवृन्द. हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे हरे, हरे राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे. So greetings from Stuyvesant Falls near Hudson or Poussin Falls, where I stay. I just got back from India on last Thursday, so this is a week, and I'm settling in. So I really haven't yet started a particular text on Wednesday night. I guess this has been going on for a while and it's been a little bit unsteady. Within the next few weeks, I will choose a text and let you know which text I'll be using. But what I thought I can do, what I've been doing here right now, is preparing the courses that I'll be giving in the next few weeks, so I can continue just sharing with you what I'm doing at the present moment. Two things are coming up on Friday here at Hudson. There's a very nice yoga studio. And just about a week or two ago in India, they just contacted me, and there seems to be a local interest. Actually, there's quite a few Krishna Bhaktas, devotees in the area, and others that have interest in spiritual life. And I can't remember how many years now I've been living here, but in quite a few years, and you just know so many people. It's a great yoga studio. It's where also Raghunath holds his teacher training. And from that, there are many people that are interested in the area. Yoga, and not just yoga, but the philosophy behind it. As you know, yoga is just, or asana is just one part of an eightfold process of progressive meditation, beginning with yam and niyam. Yam means it's all about controlling the mind, because that's what yoga is. Yoga means to control the mind. And when you control the fluctuations of the mind, it brings the mind to a condition of illumination and perception, where one can experience the soul. It's a bit of a mechanical type process. There's different philosophies in India, The Ashtanga Yoga is the, or the Yoga Sutras, Patanjali is a psychological, it's psychology. It's a very profound understanding of how the mind works. But it begins with Yam, Niyam, and it's progressive. Yam means, if you want to control the mind, the most, you have to control it at the grossest, the grossest fluctuation of the mind is improper dealings with others. So how you deal with others is Yam. And of course, that's beginning with nonviolence. So that's the starting point. You can't go further. It's like building a building, but don't have the first floor and putting up the second, third, fourth, and it's progressive. And Niyam is how you deal with yourself. And then there's Asana, which basically means that to meditate, the body has to be healthy. Otherwise, the consciousness gets absorbed in the body. So there's Asana, which is Sthira and Sukha. Happy and steady. But as people are becoming increasingly aware, that has a function within the control of the mind, but there's a much deeper philosophy behind it. So people are definitely interested in that. And I think the main text which describes the philosophy behind it, of course, is the Yoga Sutras, is the Bhagavad Gita. So I was asked to teach that. And it's a challenge because there's five classes. And I'm going to give an overview of the Bhagavad Gita. So obviously, there's a lot of information. For 10 years in Vrindavan, I used to teach the Bhagavad Gita a chapter a week, over 18 weeks. And we had fun trying to really, really master the subject and know each verse in context. It's a logical dialogue. So you have to know what is being said as the speaker is saying it. The speaker knows what's being said. The listener often doesn't understand if he doesn't have, it's not coming from the same frame of reference as the speaker. So we would kind of pride ourselves in a nice way of understanding the Bhagavad Gita in that way. I think that was maybe 15, 20 years ago that I was doing that. So I'm a little refresher. And it's a challenge because, you know, if you just give information, you won't get any contiguous theme or subject. So you have to go deep. And so I'm looking forward to that. And then on Sunday at Yoga Maya in New York, I'm giving a seminar on the yoga of forgiveness. And of course, the things that I do. You know, it's not just psychology, but it's related to yoga. And again, if control of the mind begins with yama, and the first yama is nonviolence, which means physical and mental. In fact, to be perfectly nonviolent, you really have to be free from selfish desire. Otherwise, you're going to infringe on the rights of others. So it's not that easy to perfect nonviolence. But I'm going to deal with giving up resentment and cultivating forgiveness because it's the most difficult enmity to give up because there's an apparent justification for it. And enmity puts dust on the mirror of the mind. It distorts the mirror of the mind. We all have that. In the Bhagavad Gita, it's also described, Jayato Visham Pumso, Sangas and Jayate. You know, meditate on something, you become attached, and from attachment, frustration comes, and then anger. So, and from anger comes bewilderment. So, you know, spiritual life is about perception. It's about seeing things clearly. It's about discrimination. It's about understanding reality so you can act according to reality and get the benefit of truth. So how anti-yoga is resentment, revenge, and these type of feelings, and what it does to the mind. So in Yoga Maya, they consider me the spiritual mentor. They're trying to add that element to it. So I try to give subjects that are relevant to help the people that attend that studio come to a higher level of consciousness, goodness, a higher level of perception. Spiritual life purifies the consciousness and gives you the understanding, just a higher level of perception, and that's healthy. That's healthy, and that leads one towards the goal. What to speak if you're in the process of bhakti yoga? Because bhakti yoga affirms that real advancement spiritually is the condition of the heart. Because you can be advanced in jhana, but not be compassionate. You can be advanced in austerities and not be free from anger. But you can't be advanced in bhakti or devotion. It means the purification of the heart, so especially in the process of bhakti. So I'm going to analyze the subject from many, many, many different angles. So I've actually been preparing that today. So let me just tell you a little bit about my plan. This is kind of a little bit more informal, and I will get some texts. But I divided my class up in the Bhagavad Gita. Is the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita is called Vishad Yoga. Vishad means dejection. And dejection becomes yoga when it inspires you to make a solution to your dejection, to really end the dejection. It's just like when you have a disease, you may deal with the symptoms of the disease. And then you don't really cure the disease. But sometimes when the symptoms are extremely acute, then you're forced to get to the root of the problem. So the dejection, when it becomes acute, it forces one to think philosophically and to perhaps get to the root of dejection. It's just like a scientist did an experiment. It's a horrible experiment, but of a frog. And he had very hot water and he had boiling water. And the boiling water was better for the frog than the hot water, because the boiling water, although it scalded, would force the frog to jump out. While the hot water, the frog would get used to, and it would slowly kill him. So it's described, basically, that's the condition of the world. It's degrading to the consciousness. It's covering one with ignorance. It's killing the soul. And because the nature of the soul is selfless service. And the world is promoting egotism. The difficulties, they kind of help make us want to actually transcend egotism, which is the root cause of all suffering. Because it's that sense of egotism that projects the pure soul on the body. That sense of selfishness doesn't allow us to stay in a position of self-awareness, because our pure state, our pure state is selfless. So when egotism arises, then the consciousness, that's actually the root cause. So that's why it's called Prashad Yoga. And I thought what I can do in that class is set a little bit the scene, because actually the first chapter is actually called Observing the Armies. So it shows the greater context of the Bhagavad Gita. The Bhagavad Gita is just one section, one small chapter of the Mahabharata, which culminates in a fratricidal war. And then Arjuna, getting ready for that war and being forced to fight that war, because of the aggressiveness of the opposing party, who basically wants to annihilate his family and has tortured them for many years. He's forced, against his personal desire, but it is a sense of duty to fight in the war. And then the scene comes, and this is the crux of the Bhagavad Gita, where, before the war begins, he asks Krishna, who is his charioteer, to pull his chariot and see the opposing side. And in the opposing side, he sees his teacher, he sees all his relatives. There's so many different akshohinis, and practically the commanders of each of the military sections of the opposing side is related to him in some way. So then he's faced in a dilemma of whether or not he should fight or not. And it sets up an archetype dilemma of our duty and the attachments based on ego that are impediments to our duty, and really figuring out what our duty is. But generally, we all have faced situations that are similar, where we are, Arjuna represents basically a saintly person. He has saintly qualities, he has spiritual objectives, but he also has attachment. and this is the situation that we find ourselves in, that we want to move forward in spiritual life, but there are personal attachments that we have that pose obstacles. I was just thinking, I think we all have archetypal situations in that way. I was thinking of my own personal life when I came to spiritual life. When I came to spiritual life, like almost 40 years ago, it was almost 40 years ago. Can't believe I'm that old. But my parents had opposed, very, very strongly opposed. And perhaps it's the reason why it took me many years to become a devotee. It wasn't the understanding, open environment. I mean, we can't imagine how much the world has changed with the mass media. I mean, in those particular days, I remember you couldn't, I mean, if you're from New York, you couldn't travel in Alabama, without risking your life. It was just so much prejudices and different things, and people had so little global understanding. So, my God, when this is a, I had this desire to kind of become a monk. And when I told my family that I wanted to be celibate, I remember my mother insisted in taking me to the family doctor. I remember him. And that's when family doctors would come to your home. $5, a doctor would come to your home. It seemed like it would be more opulent then. I remember the doctor would make house calls. He had a family doctor, and I remember his name, Ralph Burke, and we saw the family doctor. And I remember the doctor explaining to my mother that celibacy was injurious to my health. And, that was the level, of understanding, what to speak of. So they vehemently opposed, but eventually I had to follow my convictions, which led to them kidnapping me, the hired people, a little misunderstanding there, which is, it was understandable, but at the same time, it was reconciled many, many years ago. People can't go higher than below the standard. But I remember them trying to commit me to a mental hospital. And through the police, and the doctor said that there was nothing wrong with me. And I remember at that particular point, my parents were so much opposed that I just remember at that particular time, they threatened to actually have this traditional funeral ceremony for me if I would continue going. So I was faced with that kind of, there's a commitment. Even the Bhagavad Gita, the Bible says, honor thy mother and father. So that's one duty. And here's a duty of dedicating myself to God. And these are the situations. How do you determine duty? How do you actually determine duty? I mean, and that's what Bhagavad Gita is about. How do you actually determine what is your duty? And there's duties on different levels. There's in Sanskrit it's called naimittika and nitya. There's temporary duties and there's eternal duties. For example, you may have a duty as a child. And, well, okay, you're a child, but then you grow up, and then your parents die. Then you no longer have a duty as a child, you have a duty as a parent. So there's duties that are temporary. Someone may be a warrior, a military, but then you're a civilian. So those are temporary duties. So there's temporary duties, and then there's called nitya duties, nitya dharma, there's eternal duties. And eternal duties are the nature of the soul, and that's actually what dharma is. Because dharma, the root of dharma actually means that which sustains. That's why sometimes dharma is called occupation. It's occupation, it's translated as occupation, that which sustains your existence. But what sustains your existence is dependent on what you are. If you're the body, then your job is your dharma. You understand you're the mind, then cultivation of knowledge is your dharma. But we're not the mind and we're not the body, we're the soul. So the ultimate sustenance is spiritual. And it's your service to God is your ultimate sustenance. And other duties are done to help you progress towards and understand the ultimate duty. So Bhagavad Gita sets up these conflicting duties to actually highlight what is ultimate dharma. And therefore, ultimately, dharma can be understood as eternal nature. It's the quality, sometimes we talk about essence, it's the quality which cannot be taken away. The essence of water is liquidity. If I give you something and it's not wet, it's not water. The essence of the self, the quality which cannot be taken away, is to love and serve, because we're part of the universe. We're not the whole, we're the part. The part is meant to serve the whole by its constitution. So that's our ultimate duty, is to serve. And service, the sense of service, repose in the greatest and most universal sense is to God, because it's inclusive of everything else. It's the interest of everything else. When you actually understand who is God and what is your relationship with God, it's the most universal service, it's the most benefit to everyone, and it's inclusive of serving everyone, and service to everyone is within service to God. If you actually serve them, understanding their eternal nature as a soul, and that's what faith. Spiritual life is based on faith. It's not just a theoretical belief. I believe or I don't believe. Faith is the nature of the soul that awakens in contact with the divine manifest in its name, its devotees, its holy places, its deities. It awakens the nature of the soul. And therefore, we generally don't leave. Someone doesn't leave spiritual life just by argument. They leave by not sufficiently refreshing their faith by contact with the divine. So it's the eternal nature of the soul is to serve. And so that's the ultimate dharma, to awaken that. And other dharmas, other duties are in relationship to that. Dharma means, okay, it's the appropriate response to, we have choices to make. So many, every minute we have, how do we make the appropriate choice? How do we make the appropriate choice? And that's what dharma is. It's the appropriate choice, and it's based on two things. It's based on your eternal nature, and it's based on the condition you find yourself in now, which will dictate what is the appropriate response in every case to come towards your eternal nature. And that's really what tradition, that's what Shastra is. It gives you the understanding. And it's not easy because you have to determine out, not first that you're not the body, you have to determine what your body is. Because we often have to work through our particular desires to become free from them. And to bring ourselves to awareness of the soul. Bhagavad Gita is an analysis of dharma, really highlighting ultimately nitya dharma, the eternal dharma, the eternal nature of the soul, and how to come to an awareness at that point. And therefore, you know, there's karma yoga, and karma yoga means that you're in a particular material condition. How do you come to the platform of Jnana? How do you come to the platform of Bhakti? When you're dealing with impulses that are based on the ego. It's a very, very wonderful system how you can satisfy those desires in a way to become purified of. And so that's karma yoga. And then jnana yoga, and basically there's two paths. And usually they're determined on the association you have. There's the path of jnana, impersonal path, and there's the path of bhakti, there's the personal path. Different aspects of realizing the absolute reality. It's just like the sun. During the day, the sun is in the room. Well, the sun is in the room, but the sun is more than just its heat and light. It's a fiery ball in the sky with a particular location. And ultimately, a particular deity or ruler of that sun. There's different realizations of that. There's jnana and there's bhakti. You can realize the personal nature of God, which is inclusive of the other aspect. You can understand the eternal aspect of God, its sat nature, its eternality, separately. Anyway, there's Jnana, and Jnana is philosophical analysis. It's a path, and bhakti is devotion. There has to be an impetus for this kind of thinking. And the impetus for this kind of thinking is the dissatisfaction and tribulations we find in this world. Because what is dissatisfaction? It indicates that there's something against nature. If we have to find out what your nature is to be happy, you don't know what your nature is, you're going to go against it. And therefore the symptoms will be suffering. And then so many points come in Bhagavad Gita, therefore the necessity of the teacher. So one has the proper understanding and guidance how to proceed further. So, finding and therefore that suffering is just a symptom that we're going against nature. And if suffering is not there, then we go against nature and ultimately ruin ourselves. We annihilate ourselves. It causes, even if there's not some pain to indicate a moving away from nature, then the condition, the activities that are going against nature will progress forward to a place where we cannot correct them. Therefore, there's suffering in the world. There's some pain. It's against nature. So Arjuna is in a classic situation of despair because there's duality in the world. And if you're not realizing you're the soul, then any decision that you make, which is with ego, if you think about it, will lead to distress. Because if you're in the misconception that you're the body, then you'll suffer the illusion of non-existence. The body is temporary. The soul is eternal. You'll suffer the illusion of non-existence then. So even if you make a solution to enjoy more, to fulfill the temporary nature and desire, you do not solve the problem of non-existence, and therefore there's always a duality in whatever you attain, a great fear. Arising from that is some great fear. And also the pleasure is superficial because it doesn't touch the self. So, so Arjuna is in a situation of despair rooted in attachment to false identity. And as long as you're rooted in egotism, whichever way you turn will ultimately give the opposite result of pain. Because even if you satisfy your desires, it'll put you deeper in material illusion. It's just like hot showers. When you take a hot shower, you fortify. And, when you just try to enjoy without restriction, whatever you do, you fortify the bodily conception of life. And therefore, you suffer the pains and pleasures of the world more intensely. But an ounce of pain is felt more than a ton of pleasure. So if you just lead a life just for pleasure, we have to satisfy our desires, no doubt. But the fact of the matter is, if you fortify that conception, then you suffer more. Because though if you enjoy, you're going to feel more acutely the pain that is there in life. You're going to feel more acutely the pain that's there. So you're bound to wind up, as long as you're rooted in attachments in this world, without an appropriate path to satisfy and regulate them, to progress in a spiritual way. Bhagavad Gita is not about renunciation, but it's ultimately a bhakti text. And bhakti means that it's just a change of ego. When I am the controlled enjoyer, then I am the servant of God. And that conception, it doesn't matter if you take karma sannyas, you renounce the world, you stay with family. Because the conception, the internal conception is what is important. And that's changed. I'm glad because I haven't done this in a while, so speaking now clarifies my thoughts. But I want to set up and then Krishna explains all various types of yoga, how someone in the world and how someone can. What are the different yogas? What are the different ways to become aware of the self and therefore become free from all suffering? Because the suffering is in the transformation of the body. We're not the body, but because we're identified with it, we suffer. So how to come to that pure awareness? So anyway, these are some of the things I'm going to be discussing. And next week or the week after that, it takes a while for me to get settled here. I mean, it's traveling is something, but coming back and then having to prepare this and prepare another course, I just want to be up here peacefully, look at my books and see what subject we'll cover next. Okay, anybody like to ask any questions?
Hare Krishna, Maharaj.
Hey, Gail, Hare Krishna. Thank you. Always great to hear you on the song with Ed, really.
Oh, thank you. Well, one thing is kind of interesting that you are doing the Gita now because, believe it or not, let me see, maybe 2-3 months ago, I started listening to your recordings of the your teachings on the Gita that you did in Vrindavan all those years ago.
Say that again. Are they still around?
It was put on CD.
Okay.
From all those years ago when you were teaching in India.
Really?
Yeah.
God, that's the stuff again. And you've been listening to that?
For the past, few months. It's been slow going for me because, I do a lot of review, like replay. Replay a lot, so it's slow going. So I'm only like in chapter 3, But it's funny because I've been wondering, while I've been listening, I wonder how Maharaj's presentation of the Gita would be different today with all of his new realizations after all of these years. And now I'm getting my answer.
Okay. Yeah, because that was 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
In one sense,
the realizations are really so wonderful to get from them. Yeah.
Oh, you mean to get them today?
Yeah, I mean the points that you make are they make the philosophy so clear,
Well,
and so it's a very fulfilling experience.
Thank you, Gail. Yeah, in one sense, I knew the Gita better. In other words, I used to be able to take any chapter. I had one course where I would just give, five classes a week on a chapter of the Gita. But then I had one course, it was like a shortened course, where I'd speak in 1 hour a whole chapter. And it required that you knew each person in context. And we had that kind of pride at that time, you know. But then what happened is as you remember, we started the Bhakti Shastri course school in New Jersey. And then Bhakti Shore began teaching. And then the next year, Mahamuni began teaching, you know. So I saw all these young, brilliant people coming up. And in one sense, they would almost take it further, you know, because they would have whatever realizations I would have, and then they would study it further. So, and then I went on to the...
I studied the Mahamuni also.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't get to the whole thing, but we got maybe up to the fourth chapter.
Okay.
But I am... I don't know if I have that. I did have a quick question, though. Well, I don't know how quick.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, to do our dharma requires great sacrifice and, you know, to tolerate the austerities of doing a dharma can, you know, be a source of suffering, actually. And so how can we distinguish between the suffering of acting adharmically and the suffering of just tolerating the austerities of dharma?
Well, I mean, it says in the Upadeshamrita, it says that, you know, that which is nectar at the beginning is poison at the end, and that which is poison is nectar. So sometimes, you know, it's just like a boil. You know, there may be some pain, but you get relief, you know, like you get it out. So sometimes there's that factor. Also, the Bhagavatam says, Tapodivyam Yena Kaputva Tattvam Shubye Madhvata Sokyam. That tapa or austerity is divine. Because austerity means that you do your dharma despite the irrational impulses of the mind and the body. So obviously there's some type of suffering when you are going against your attachments. But at the same sense, there's a happiness that comes because you're no longer affected by the fluctuations of the body because you're extracting your mind from it when you go undergo some difficulty in spiritual life for the sake of self-realization. So yeah, there's temporary suffering, but be sure that, you know, it's, and also you have to understand that suffering and happiness is not just the pain and pleasure of the senses, it's the condition of the mind. So sometimes you undergo suffering externally, but the consciousness gets elevated. I remember when I was taking a philosophy course in college, and the teacher was a real rascal. He was a debauchee. And I noticed that all the attractive girls didn't really have to come to the class and they'd get good grades. And I kind of knew what was going on. And, you know, one time he was such a hedonist, he said that happiness is material pleasure. And I just said, that's ridiculous. I told him. I said, if that's the case, then if someone's depressed, just give them an ice cream cone, you know? So there's obviously a dichotomy between sensual pleasure and happiness and between, you know, sensual distress and unhappiness. Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, it's nice for me here, too. I mean, I like doing the Bhagavatam, the CC, but it's nice to go back to the Gita like this. So, you know, very good. Okay, well, thanks, Dale. That's encouraging to me that you have those CDs of those Bhagavad Gita classes. I would like to see myself what I was saying at those times, you know.
Yeah, they're on two CDs, you know, part one and part two.
Okay, that's great. Thank you. Okay, would anybody else like to say hello today?
Hare Krishna Guru Maharaj, this is Govardhan.
Govardhan, you invited me over. I'm going to get back to you in a day or two about the program, okay?
Right. Thank you.
I'll let you know when I can do it and you know, when the right time. Okay? Good. Anybody else like to say hello? Okay. Then for today, thank you all. Anshukalpa Thirubhya Chakra Sindhu Gabachapati Tram Papa Nebula.